We're going to start with Come, Come, Whoever You Are, and English, Spanish, and Spanish. So you can stand or sit if you want. That was the last one.
We could sing another one.
We could sing another one.
What do we know?
Why don't we, how about 1017 in your teal hymnal? We are building a new way. Yeah, let's just do the first verse, and I didn't know that one.
Huh?
I was trying to fill up time, so we were going to do another one. So,
but have you done the other two?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I'll leave this one.
Okay.
How's everybody doing this morning? This will be the second time I have started worship late in my entire ministry, so I offer my apologies and gratitude for your patience. How many folks remember this? We've sung this before. Okay. Goes like this. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water,
cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am.
Please rise. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. So you notice that healing, powerful, so it's a soft and light song, but it's sung with power. And the way you find that is you push out from your belly. That's where you find the strength. So let's sing it again.
Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing,
I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. And I invite you now to greet your neighbors as you continue singing.
Healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful.
Good morning.
Healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am.
Just being gentle. I was trying to be gentle on your hand. All right. Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the First Church of Alton. My name is Joy Heft. Welcome to this place. This is a home where no revealed truths are promoted and no scripture or human being accepted as infallible. This is a place for searching for the truth. But we are believers. We believe in intellectual freedom. We believe in justice. We believe in compassion and concern for each other and the whole world. We believe in commitment to those ideals which make us caring and active in the struggles for human dignity. We are Unitarian Universalists. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular, Those who are first-time visitors, we welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after worship for coffee and conversation. Information about the church is available from the new member desk during coffee hour and from any of the people here gathered. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards found in the back of your hymnal and place it in the offering plate or give it to an usher. We'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the programs and activities going on here at the church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you again on future Sundays. We do have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. Due to the mature nature of today's topic, elementary age are invited to go to the nursery when we sing Children on Their Way. We welcome everyone in this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. Okay, announcements. I have one announcement. And it was from yesterday for Saturday lunch, which was last week. And then Sunshine has.
Good morning. My name is Reverend Sunshine Jeremiah Wolf. I am the interim minister here at the First Unitarian Church of Alton. That means that I am only here on a set amount of time and that I cannot be hired by this congregation for at least 10 years after my service, so it's a very limited field. And I'm here to help this congregation while they are in search for a settled minister who hopefully will be selected about 10 to 11 months from now. I have a couple of announcements. One, how many of you are planning on going to Camp Fest? Yes. Have all of you signed up for Camp Fest? That is the important thing. So make sure that you register for Camp Fest. The order, registration's online, or you can contact Sayer Johnson or Juliet. Camp Fest is our annual gathering. It happens at some point during the summer up at Pier Marquette, and I hear we have the good campsite. The final planning meeting for Camp Fest will be next Sunday after service by the fireside. So if you are interested in helping with the planning and implementation of Camp Fest, please be here at that time. As you've noticed, we've gone to our 10 o'clock service. We will be at the 10 o'clock service for the remainder of the summer. I have three more sermons that I will preach in June, and then I will be away. But June is also a busy month. I will be in a conference the first week of June at General Assembly for 10 days at the end of June, and then I will be, God is willing and the creek don't rise, on vacation and study leave for the month of July, except to come back for the wedding of Paula and Larry. So know that that's coming up and that I will be away. Yeah, everybody's kind of smiling. And I believe that concludes. No, I remember I forgot. So speaking of General Assembly and my time away, General Assembly happens online, and I'm looking for one brave volunteer who would be willing to help us have General Assembly Alton, where we would live stream some of the major events, including the speech by Cornell West, live here at the church. So if you're interested in helping with that, please let me know. Thank you.
We begin this service this morning with a prelude. The smell of her hair, the taste of her mouth, the feeling of her skin seemed to have gotten inside him, or into the air around him. She'd become a physical necessity, from George Orwell's book, 1984. And as Ben Heff lights our chalice,
It says my name on it, that's why.
Yeah.
I didn't correct it from last week, so I'll do it, that's fine. If you can't tell, I'm ready for vacation. I feel like I'm a little all over the map today, I apologize. Please join me in reciting this morning's chalice lighting. We light this chalice, symbol of Unitarian Universalism. Oh, no, ignore that. Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. I invite you to please rise as your spirits and bodies allow and join in singing hymn number 1017, We Are Building a New Way. Congregation last week voted on its covenant, which has been working on for quite some time, and started yet another way to build relationship, love, and community. I invite you to please join in reciting the new congregational covenant, otherwise known as the HERE covenant, H-E-R-E. To strengthen and nurture our welcoming community with love, compassion, and respect, we covenant together to honor and make space for our diversity, respect our volunteers, leaders, and staff by supporting balance in their lives and in their personal and professional pursuits. Encourage each member to develop a personal spiritual practice that cultivates honesty and acceptance. Remembering our humanness, we acknowledge our imperfection and extend forgiveness to ourselves and others. Engage with our own and the larger community with integrity by taking responsibility for our actions, facilitating right relationships, and living into the journey. Thank you. In the coming weeks, we will have a printed copy for everyone. And do not feel like you have to remember every last letter of that. That is not the purpose of a covenant. If you feel like you have to memorize it, memorize the four words: honor, encourage, remember, and engage. If you can do that, you'll be doing just fine. So I know we don't have any children in the space, but if you haven't figured out by now, stories aren't just for children. Well, Ben's here. I'm sorry, Ben, like I'm excluding you. But today's story is about what we do when people are not treating us well, particularly when you think about bullies. Now, what is a bully? Can anybody tell me? Say that? Picking on someone, putting someone down, right? Typically, it's a person who feels a lack of control in their life and so tries to find control by putting it onto others. And that can come in the form of beating up somebody or being mean in words or in deeds or starting rumors. So there's cyberbullying. That's where people make fun of other people online to the point where it ruins a reputation. There's all kinds of ways that bullying can occur. One of the worst forms of bullying is something called sexual abuse. And that's when somebody touches someone when they shouldn't or don't want to be touched in a certain way, or says something sexually when it's not appropriate to, those kinds of things. So this story is about what you do in the event that somebody's bullying you, in whatever form it may be. And it requires you to remember three words. Think you can remember three words? The first word is no. No. And when you're telling someone no in a bullying situation, it's no, right?
No.
There you go. The second word you need to remember is go. Just go.
Go.
Go. And the third word you need to remember is tell. Tell. Right? And so here's how it works. Once upon a time, there was a squirrel named Martin. Now, Martin was really getting anxious about going to school, because every morning on his way to school, Deirdre the bunny would hop all over him. Just hop and hop and bounce on him and get his clothes dirty and disheveled and beat him up. And he didn't know what to do. And when he would walk into school, Mrs. B, his teacher, would say, "Oh, Martin, you shouldn't play in the mud before school. You look all a mess." And at recess, the kids would start to pick on him and call him a loser and a freak. And Deirdre would hop all over him again. He didn't know what to do. And after a while of being beaten up in this way and being picked on and whatnot, he started to believe what they were saying. He really started to think he was a loser and that he was a freak and that he didn't have any worth at all. Have anybody experienced something like that? I know I did when I was in school. It's not uncommon, unfortunately. So this went on for some time, and he didn't know what to do, and he felt like everybody just thought he was this loser and freak and deserved to be beaten up the way he was being beaten up and called the names he was being called. And then one day, there was a new student at school. Her name was Allison the Reptile. And Allison was quiet, and she seemed very confident. And that day at recess, she saw Deirdre start hopping all over Martin. And so she runs up and gets in Deirdre's face and says, "No." Exactly. She said, "No, you will not do this." And Deirdre's like, "Well, who are you? I'm a rabbit, you're a reptile. I'll take care of you, no problem." And Allison realizes that Deirdre's about to hop all over her and yells to Martin, "Go."
"Go."
Right. And so he runs. And Deirdre's about to pounce on her when she runs too. And if you know reptiles, they can run pretty quickly, right? And so they run inside the school, but Deirdre follows them. So they've already said no, and they've already gone. They went. But here comes this person, Deirdre, and Deirdre says, "You better not tell anybody what happened today, or I'll break your legs." Deirdre's not very nice, is she? I wonder what's going on for Deirdre that she's acting this way. So she runs back off to continue recess, and Allison and Martin are sitting there, and Martin's still shaking. You know, he's still scared, and he goes, how did you get Deirdre to leave me alone? Because this is the first time she hasn't continued to hop all over me. And Allison said, well, my last school, I was beaten up too, and I was beaten up so often, my parents decided we had to move. So we just moved here, and this is my new school, and I don't want the bullying to happen again. But we also took classes, and they told me what to do when this happens again. And the first thing you do is say,
no.
And if that doesn't work, then you
go.
And if that doesn't work, then you tell. But she said if we tell, she'll break our legs. Yeah, she did, but she probably said that out of fear that we would, not because she will. And besides, once we tell people, she can't really do anything anyway. And so they went to Mrs. B and told her what had happened. And Mrs. B apologized profusely to Martin. I was like, Martin, why didn't you tell me? He said, well, I thought I deserved it. Oh, no one deserves that, Martin. And so, the next thing they know, Deirdre wasn't at school for a few days. And the class started talking about bullying and being mean to one another. And they learned three important words. What are they?
No. No. Tell.
Exactly. And they, Martin and Allison, taught those same rules to the younger grades, and their school put up a big sign that said, no bullying zone, only love here. And they shared their wisdom, and any time somebody started to act like a bully, they would say no. Now Deirdre got some help. Her and her parents went to counseling and helped her work through some of the things that she was dealing with so that she was able to eventually apologize to Martin and Allison. They were never really good friends all the way through high school. But Deirdre never picked on them or anyone else again, and they learned to live in community and be in relationship together. So always remember,
no, go, tell.
Thank you. We have no children to sing on our way, so we will skip that part. Each week we take some time to recognize the joys and sorrows within this community. This time we're experimenting with a new way of doing joys and sorrows, where people come forward and place a stone in the bowl of water. Each week when you come in, you will find stones in a bowl at the front and the back of the sanctuary, which you are welcome to hold on to during the service. And I recommend one of two practices as you do this. If you are more humanist and atheist and tend to think more about psychology and other things as a way to deal with your sorrows and your joys, I invite you to use the stones as a placeholder, a way to bring to your consciousness those joys and sorrows that you may be living with, and to have them held in your mind so that you may be able to receive help and support. And for those of you who may be in the more spiritual or theistic or looking to God, you can think of putting the energy of your joys and sorrows in the stones and releasing them into the cleansing water. During our meditation time, we'll have a time for you to say the names, places, and events of things you wish to be lifted up within this community. At this time, if you have a joy or a sorrow, I invite you to come forward and take a stone and place it in the bowl of water, a ritual of joys and sorrows.
Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am.
Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing, powerful, healing, changing, I am. Born of water, cleansing,
We place a stone in the water for those joys and sorrows lying in the silent sanctuaries of our hearts, and a stone for those who could not be with us in this community today. I invite you now into a time of meditation, prayer, or contemplation, as is your own personal spiritual practice. O Spirit of life, mystery of mind beyond our knowing, still small voice within our spirits and hearts, we open ourselves this day to wonderment, to grace, and to love. In a world that tries us, a world that troubles us, a world that challenges us, we open our hearts and our minds to the transformation that comes from the only constant in living, change. We offer blessings to those experiencing major time of change in their life, particularly to the Fordyce family and to Kelsey Fordyce, whose memorial service was yesterday, and to all those who've experienced the loss of loved ones, of fathers and grandfathers, mothers and grandmothers, parents, friends, the many people who have made the ultimate change in life into death. And we offer gratitude and blessings for those who have made the change into being, to those born to us and to the children, ever reminding us of the preciousness and wonder of life. May we remember that those joys and struggles in our lives exist side by side, and that we can often feel joy and hope at the same time as despair and loss. May we know that we are enough to face the struggles in our lives, and that we are enough to be worthy of all that is good. At this time, I invite those here gathered to share the names, events, and places they wish to lift up in an embracing meditation. Sandra Snyder. Is at war. I invite you now into a time of precious silence for your own personal prayer, meditation, or contemplation. as we come back into this space. I invite you to take a slow, deep breath in and out. And again, so your neighbor can hear you, in and out. And one more time, in and out. May we be blessed by this community, and may we be ever grateful for this most amazing world in its complexity and diversity. And may we know we are enough always. Blessed be.
The words of Paul Beadle. Once upon a time, most folks used the offering plate to fulfill their pledges of financial support. Nowadays, lots of folks click on their church websites or set up an automatic transfer from their checking accounts. Some still write a monthly check paying their church bill along with the others. But passing the offering plate was never just a practical exercise. It has always been a ritual. Even if your pledge is paid up, it is worthwhile for you to bring even just a dollar to drop into the plate as a ritual reminder of that form of love we call generosity. Let it be a reminder that after meeting our obligations to ourselves and our households and the communities to which we belong and are committed, we must still keep our capacity to give. The practice of giving, until it is second nature and first response, helps bring forth the realm of love. The offering will now be gratefully received. May it be lovingly given.
Please join me in reciting our offertory blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves, and these are offerings.
Our reading from the book of Romans 13:8-10. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law, the commandments. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall not covet. And any other commandment are summed up in this word. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is fulfilling of the law. If you join us in our next hymn, number 18, What Wondrous Love.
Tell you, there's something in the air today. Oh, well, I'm happy to blame Mercury. There we go.
Porn is different from sex in real life. Let's find out how. Porn star penises are 6 to 9 inches. Civilian penis? 5 to 7. And while porn stars have very little hair down there, in real life 65% of women and 85% of men do. Indeed, female porn privates tend to sport a similar look. But real-world vaginas come in all shapes, sizes, and colors. As for arousal, Real people need 10 to 12 minutes to get going, while porn stars... Male performers can hump for days, but in real life, 75% of men ejaculate within 3 minutes. And though porn starlets seem to always have an orgasm through penetration alone, 71% of women don't. Now what about all the other stuff? Unlike porn stars, only 11.5% of women have had a same-sex experience. And only 40% of women have tried anal. Just 22% say they'll take a hot load in the face. And only 30% will actually swallow said load. The portion of women who've been in a threesome is less than 20%. And while the internet is awash in female squirters, only 6% of women say they regularly gush forth. Finally, what about light bondage? Well, only 40% have tried it. Wait, that's actually quite a lot. So there you go. That's the difference between porn sex and real sex. Feeling hungry?
You lost your appetite. See, it was worth a wait. Some of you are like, Sunshine, have you completely lost your marbles?
Simon?
Yay. All right. It's the sex sermon, every minister's favorite. One of the signs of a sexually healthy congregation is one that's willing to talk about sex and willing to talk about it on Sunday. And it may seem odd that I showed that particular video at church, but I think that it illustrates the basic point at which I want to get today, which is the difference between what we often teach, even our children, through our culture, through our media, through our politics, and what is real and true are worlds apart. That oftentimes we don't give accurate information, we don't help people know what is to be true, and it causes problems in the real world. This great divide between the real and the true can have its place in its fantasy life, however, when it is combined with a long history of puritanical attitudes about sex and sexuality, it can become dangerous. And let's remember, those puritanical attitudes are in the foundation of our religious community in the Unitarians, who started out as Puritans, and who actually lived a lot of those puritanical values well into the 1900s. In their book, The Ethical Slut, by Dossie Easton and Catherine List, they put it this way. Our culture positively worships self-denial. We can certainly say that we see the path of sex negativism and living in sexual deprivation as a harmful one. Self-loathing, hatred of one's own body and sexuality, fear and guilt over one's own sexual urges are the outcome. We see ourselves surrounded by the walking wounded, by people who have been deeply, if not irrevocably, injured by fear, shame, hatred of their own sexual selves. We believe that happy, connected sex is the cure of these wounds, that it is important, possibly even essential, to most people's sense of self-worth, to their belief that life is good. We have never met anyone who had low self-esteem at the moment of orgasm. This self-denial permeates every aspect of U.S. culture, from our media to our churches, to our work lives and relationships, and even the ways in which we raise our children. Just this week, it was reported that the eldest child of the Duggar family, Josh Duggar, sexually molested his sisters and another family friend at the mere age of 14. Some of you may have heard of the Duggar family from the TV reality show 19 Kids and Counting. This is a reality show that follows the life of one Arkansas family who follows the Quiverful movement. Quiverful people believe that it is their duty to have as many children as possible to literally create the army of believers that will save the world. In addition, the Duggars follow strict rules for courting, for dress, and conservative Christian values. Sex is not something discussed. It is saved for after marriage and for the right moment. It is no surprise that in a family that limits and controls all information about sex and sexuality, that their son would act out. What is more concerning in the story of denial of sexuality is that once discovered, his family strived to cover up the misconduct. They failed to follow through on treatment for Josh or counseling for the girls that he touched. Now, let's be clear, this is a symptom of a larger problem. It would be easy to demonize the Duggar family, which is not the point here. The point is that in a society that is becoming increasingly controlling in how it disseminates information to children through abstinence-only education, shaming of any kind of sexual activity, though more for girls than for boys, and leaving the only main depictions of sexuality to the fantasy world, we must recognize that as a society, we're in trouble. The 1960s changed the face of sex forever. Who was around for the 60s? Remember some of that? Yes. And all I can say is thank you for that. In fact, it is because of the sexual freedom and experimentation of the 1960s that the original Unitarian Universalist sexuality curriculum about your sexuality was created in response to parents who didn't know how to help their children grow up in the 1960s and beyond. Among the more controversial aspects of the curriculum then, even as it is today, were pictures depicting real-life encounters, both amorous and sexual in nature. The goal was to demystify sex and portray a real picture for children and youth who were increasingly being exposed to unrealistic standards for relationships, both amorous and sexual. These past couple of years, we have seen perhaps one of the most dangerous examples of this break between reality and fantasy in the 50 Shades of Grey franchise, both the books and the movie. What is most dangerous about this franchise is not that it displays BDSM, bondage, domination, submission, sadism, and masochism, as play, but rather the lack of ethically healthy relationships that are portrayed. In her book, Love Does No Harm, Sexual Ethics for the Rest of Us, Reverend Dr. Marie Fortune writes it this way: I start from what may sound like a negative place, doing the least harm. Why not doing the most good? Or making justice, you may well ask? These are the vision of possibility for which we may strive in relationship, but doing less harm is probably what we are capable of. Doing least harm is a realistic and tangible goal to set ourselves. The Hippocratic Oath from the 5th century BCE requires physicians to keep patients from harm and injustice. This simple and profound expectation is essential to love making justice in any relationship. The key thing being that in an ethical, realistic relationship, we do no harm to others. And what I would maintain is that as a society, we are doing harm by not talking about sex. By having even the video we watch today seem circumspect, instead of being healthy and important information for adults to have. How do we maintain healthy relationships when what we see predominantly in movies are women equivocating to men, almost rapey sex scenes or sex scenes that don't show the noises and stickiness and uncertainty and the curiosity of learning about your lover, but somehow create these beings that magically know just exactly how and what to do in a sexual relationship? Anybody had that experience? They just knew what to do from the very beginning? No, because that's not how we operate. In fact, it's easy to argue that the healthiest relationship is the one in which we can be messy and uncertain, in which we recognize that relationships are imperfect and holy. So how do you do the least amount of harm, or how do you do no harm in a sexual life? Again, I return to the book, The Ethical Slut, and while I know the title is provocative, it is a book about polyamory communities, but it has a great sense of explaining healthy relationships and sexual living. And so I share some of the wisdom from this book. Most of our criteria for ethics are quite pragmatic. Is anyone being harmed in the relationship? Is there any way to avoid causing harm? Are there risks? Is everybody involved aware of those risks and doing what can be done to minimize them? And on the positive side, how much fun is it? Imagine that as a metric for ethics. How much fun is it? What is everybody learning from it? Is it helping someone to grow? How many of you can think of a place in society where sex is described as a way to help you grow? Not many places for that, is there? Is it helping make the world a better place? There's a good one. Is sex helping make the world a better place? I would say if it is not helping making the world a better place, it's not a sexual relationship you should be in. It is not doing you or the world any good. In other words, is it making you more of a person, making all the people you are in relationship more of a being so that when you go out in the world, you share that joy in your life? You don't have to share the details of your sex. Come on. That's not what we're saying. So there are a few key things, kind of like our no-go-tell rules for children, that are important to help adults and help our society come into a healthier relationship with sex. The first is always consent. Perhaps one of the most disturbing scenes, at least in the movie, I will own that I have not read the books, is a point at which the Mr. Gray decides that he wants to try something, and the girl is not interested. And he just kind of says, oh no, just give it a try. The thing about consent is that it needs to be full consent. If it is coercive in any way, it is not consensual. Oftentimes when a person says no, it doesn't mean no forever, but it does mean that trust needs to be built. Consent implies that we respect the needs and pleasures of the other person. We see this failure of consent in all kinds of ways, not the least of which has been the bastion of rapes on college campuses in recent history, among many other things. But perhaps what is most disturbing in our very Christocentric culture is a tendency towards obedience in all things that removes from particularly children and youth the ability to issue consent to an adult in power, because the first rule given to them is that of obedience. We are not an obedient lot as Unitarian Universalists, so that's not a massive concern, but it is something we should be aware of in the lives of our children and our youth and even ourselves in relationship with others. The second thing is honesty with oneself and with the people around you. Know thyself. Be aware of what you're interested in. Be aware of what you need. The third thing is to recognize ramifications of your sexual choices. This is perhaps what abstinence education has done to most harm people in today's society, because we prevent our children and our youth from knowing the ramification of the choices that they will make into the future. And I should note, when I say children, I'm not talking about actual sex. With children, we're talking about relationships, friendships, and how to have healthy ones. And why we talk about bullying with children is because how they respond to bullying in their early life says a lot about how they're going to respond to abusive or non-abusive relationships in their later life. So the ramifications of those sexual choices, helping them understand and helping ourselves understand the impact of the kinds of things that we engage in. How does it impact our partner or partners? How does it impact our children, our loved ones? Recognizing the ramifications of our choices. The fourth thing is to be respectful of the other person's feelings, to recognize that their feelings are their own, yes, and when you are in a relationship with someone, the best thing you can do is listen. The majority of people in the United States have either experienced sexual abuse or rape, or know someone personally that it is happening to at the time it is happening, and often feel unsafe to report it. Being respectful of others' feelings means risking our own integrity and safety to help another person not experience pain and violence. In some cases, doing the least harm means speaking up when you may be afraid for your life. Respect of others' feelings means being present to the needs of your lover, to the person that you spend your days with. To know that their feelings matter, and yet not to take them on as your own. Which leads to the fifth thing and final thing, which is to own one's own feelings. And I actually think this is perhaps at the top of the list, because we have a lot of work to do when it comes to being aware of our own feelings as a society and as individuals. And perhaps the most common place where we see this come up is in the issue of jealousy, of feeling like we have ownership over another person because we love them, which is complicated for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which is that it's biologically impossible to control someone's attraction to other people. In fact, I promise you right now that every single person in this room, whether in a relationship or not, will see somebody that they're attracted to in the next 24 hours. Because that's healthy and normal. It's what we do with that information that becomes the question. Now, I have a friend who likes to say, I don't believe in monogamy, I believe in fidelity. And he actually teaches BDSM classes across Indiana. And his point in saying that was that at the end of the day, you keep your commitments to the people you are committed to. So if you have promised to love one person, you love that one person and you don't get into relationships with others. That doesn't mean you're not going to turn your head and see someone else's beautiful or whatever, but you keep that promise. Or if you're like Dan Savage, and I know many of us are not, but if you are like Dan Savage in his use of being monogamish, which is identifying healthy relationships of lifelong standing, say you've been in a relationship for 50 years, in his humble opinion, if you only had one or two affairs, that was a good relationship. That's being monogamish. It means holding fidelity to the person that you've committed to for life while recognizing the boundaries of your own needs. But whatever comes into that, whatever your own rules for each of your relationships are, you keep the promises that you make. And you recognize that it is healthy and normal to feel jealousy, to feel territorial, and there is no need to react or to respond to it. So there are five things: consent, honesty with yourself and with others, recognizing the ramifications for sexual choices, respect for others' feelings, and respect for your own feelings. In a world where you have to ask the question like this, your partner is playing World of Warcraft online. Your partner's avatar has sex with another avatar, all on the computer. Were they unfaithful? Right? Not an easy question to answer, I'll tell you. Here is how it works with these ethical rules. You are honest with your partner. Yes, my elf did have sex with that dwarf. You recognize the ramifications of those choices that you made to have your avatars have sex, and you respect the other person's feelings. And the other person may not care, it's just pixels on a screen, or it may be deeply painful to them that you would do that. Whichever it is, you respect their feelings for it, and you respect your own, and you redefine the boundaries of your relationship. In a world where we get to ask such questions, where people are meeting more and more online and through electronic communication and social media, these are the important questions to ask. The ethics of sexuality is not simple. But in a society that prevents us from talking about it, that makes it something that's taboo even after the sexual revolution of the 1960s, we are faced with difficult moral choices in how we live our lives and how we help our children and our youth live those lives. Unitarian Universalism, at least since the 1970s, has said sex is something we're going to talk about and we're going to make it real, just like the video we watched. And at the end of the day, we're going to make it just as Paul said in Romans, about loving your neighbor as yourself, and that anything that does not live into that love does not fulfill the promises we make each other in our relationships, no matter how messy they may be. So, may you have fun. May you enjoy sex. No matter how old you are, people have sex well into their hundreds. It's not something that's limited to the youth of America. Again, one of those falsehoods of television and books. I love making the elder folks blush. That's fun. It's about having a lot of fun and being healthy and enjoying life, because we believe in saying yes to life, right? Do we believe in saying yes? Yes. Good. That concludes today's sermon. I invite you to rise as your bodies and spirits allow and join in singing our closing hymn, Life Calls Us On. Across the chandelier towards your neighbors. Make sure you look at someone you haven't seen today. Give them a smile. This is your most holy and sacred community. It is through your hands, your hearts, your minds, and your wisdom that we make a world worthy of ourselves and the beauty and wonderment it holds. May we hold that mystery. May we live healthy into our relationships, be they sexual, loving, familial, friendial, friendship-based, may you know that it's in your practice that you make change and love in the world. May it be so.